Japan gets hit with a powerful earthquake.
So the whole room was shaking, the TV was shaking.
Israel's Supreme Court strikes down a key component of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious judicial overhaul.
It sparked months of nationwide protests and caused a deep rift in Israel and concern over the country's democratic principles among Western allies.
And the world passes a major milestone. There are now 8 billion people on planet Earth.
How many people can the Earth feed and support?
Today is Tuesday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Moments of terror inside an apartment in Japan as a powerful 7.5 magnitude earthquake hit on Monday. The epicenter was in central Japan. There have been a number of deaths, and the quake triggered tsunami waves more than a meter high. Here's Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones.
Residents rushed to evacuate from coastal areas as the quake, according to public broadcaster NHK, triggered waves of more than 3 feet along parts of the Sea of Japan. It also destroyed buildings, knocked out power to thousands of homes, and disrupted flights in the region. Following the quake, which had a preliminary magnitude of 7.6, the Japan Meteorological Agency has issued tsunami warnings for the coastal prefectures of Ishikawa, Niigata, and Toyama. The major tsunami warning was the first since 2011. Russia has also issued tsunami warnings in its far eastern cities of Vladivostok and Nakhodka. Tourist Baldwin Chia experienced the quake from Japan's Alps.
So the whole room was shaking, the TV was shaking. I had to keep everything on the table. I did feel safe in my room though, but everything else was shaking.
Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said on NHK that authorities are assessing the extent of any damage and residents need to prepare for more potential tremors.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. Police and local authorities early on Tuesday reported bodies were being pulled from the rubble of collapsed buildings. And Prime Minister Kishida said there are numerous casualties at the time of our deadline. The death toll could rise. Japan is used to strong earthquakes. It's located in the Pacific Ring of Fire, which is known for its seismic activity. The first reliably documented earthquake in Japan happened in the year 599. Joining us now is Lin-Hsing Meng, an associate professor of geophysics at the UCLA Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences.
We call it a focal mechanism, which is what type of fault is generating the earthquake. It has a tsunami, but it's like maybe a meter. It wasn't particularly damaging, but the shaking is pretty strong.
I saw the video. It looked like it shook for quite a long time relative to other earthquakes we've seen.
Oh yeah, so the duration of the earthquake is proportional to the magnitude in general. So I expect something like this probably longer, so it should be around 1 minute.
I saw it was the epicenter was quite close to the coastline.
In general, the big earthquakes in Japan should be on the east coast of the island, and that's where we have the subduction zone where Pacific plate goes under the Eurasia plate, but on the western side of the island, you have a series of shallow reverse faults. I mean, that's a type of fault, but it's a smaller fault, but it's shallower, and it's accommodating the compression within the Eurasia plate. So the earthquakes are fewer there, but they could be, because they are shallow, so the shaking could be really strong, and they are probably closer to the island itself.
So they're in what we call the Ring of Fire, isn't that correct?
Yeah, the Ring of Fire refers to the subduction zone, one plate goes under the other one, all around the Pacific, right? So this one technically is not on the boundary between two plates, but it's close. You know, like most of these motions happens on the plate boundary. Like a plate itself is considered rigid. But when you get really close to the plates, like this one, sometimes it can the deformation can activate some smaller faults, but could be less frequent, but could be also large earthquakes as well.
In Japan, earthquakes are not as uncommon as they are in other parts of the world. They're actually more used to this than other places.
Yes. Right. They do very well. They have a very strict building code. They have tsunami dams around their coast. Yeah, but this side, to western side, people generally expecting smaller tsunamis than to the eastern side.
Lin Sing Meng, an associate professor of geophysics at the UCLA Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences. Israel's Supreme Court struck down a key component of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious judicial overhaul Monday, a move Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll says is a landmark decision that could reopen the fissures in Israeli society that preceded the country's ongoing war against Hamas.
Israel's Supreme Court on Monday struck down a highly disputed law that limited court oversight passed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing government. The law was part of a broader judicial overhaul proposed by Netanyahu and his coalition of religious and nationalist partners. It sparked months of nationwide protests and caused a deep rift in Israel and concern over the country's democratic principles among Western allies. The law took away the court's ability to void such decisions that it deemed unreasonable. 8 of the 15 justices ruled to nullify this law, which the court said, quote, causes severe and unprecedented harm to the core characteristics of Israel as a democratic state. Netanyahu's Likud party said the Supreme Court's decision was unfortunate and that it opposed, quote, the will of the people for unity, especially during wartime. Yair Lapid, opposition chair and a former prime minister, praised the court, whose decision, he said, quote, seals a tough year of dispute that tore us apart from the inside. Some Israeli officials have acknowledged that the internal divisions caused by the judicial overhaul may have factored into Hamas's decision to carry out its October 7th killing spree.
Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll. On the war front, Israel is pulling thousands of troops from Gaza in the first significant drawdown of forces since the war began. Here's Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen with that story.
Israel is withdrawing some of its forces from Gaza to shift to more targeted operations against Hamas, an official said on Monday. These soldiers were seen repairing equipment at a base near the Gaza border. A base commander said they would return to the enclave soon. The shift to mopping up operations signals a new phase in Israel's offensive and is expected to last for months. Some of the troops pulled out of Gaza would be prepared for rotation to the northern border with Lebanon, an official said. The reduction would also allow some reservists to return to civilian life, shoring up Israel's war-battered economy. On Monday, the U.S. Navy announced the Gerald R. Ford aircraft carrier was returning to its home port in Virginia after being deployed to the eastern Mediterranean following the outbreak of hostilities. The war in Gaza has reduced much of the territory to rubble and plunged its 2.3 million people into a humanitarian disaster. Palestinian health authorities say around 22,000 people have been killed. The assault on the enclave followed the surprise Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th, in which Israel said 1,200 people were killed and 240 taken hostage. Israel's defense minister said Monday that some of the Israeli communities north of the Gaza Strip that were evacuated would be able to return in the near future. At this Palestinian tent camp in Rafah on New Year's Eve, children played in the sand while they focused on their survival. This 11-year-old girl said her wish for 2024 was not to die. There is no bathroom, no food, no water. Our childhood is gone, she said. Nearby at the Rafah Zoo, displaced people camped out between cages, holding starving animals. Some of the families sheltering here say they cannot afford food themselves.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Fighting continued in Ukraine as well on Monday, with Russia launching a record number of drones against Ukraine. The latest now from Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall.
Russia launched a record 90 Shahed-type drones across Ukraine during the early hours of the new year, and President Vladimir Putin said his country would intensify its attacks on its neighbor. Putin said Ukraine could expect more such strikes after shelling the Russian border city of Belgorod that killed more than 2 dozen people and wounded more than 100 others. Putin called that a terrorist act. In Ukraine, a 15-year-old boy was killed and 7 people wounded after falling debris from one of 87 downed Russian drones hit a residential building in the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa. I'm Norman Hall.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Hundreds of people in Kosovo rushed to Pristina Airport to travel to EU countries on Monday after visas for Europe's open borders Schengen zone were waived.
We have been waiting for too long. This has been a long injustice, but finally we made it.
Kosovo's Prime Minister Albin Kurti. Kosovo was the only country in the Western Balkans whose citizens still needed visas to travel to the EU. Landlocked Ethiopia signed an initial agreement with Somalia's breakaway region, Somaliland, on Monday to use its Red Sea port, Berbera. Somaliland President Bihi Abdi said as part of the agreement, Ethiopia would be the first country to recognize Somaliland as an independent nation in due course. Pakistan's Independent Human Rights Commission said Monday there is little chance of free and fair parliamentary elections in the country next month because of pre-poll rigging. It also expressed concern about authorities rejecting the candidates of former Prime Minister Imran Khan and most other members of his party. At a news conference in Islamabad, the co-chairperson of the commission said at this point, there is little evidence to show that the upcoming elections will be free, fair, or credible. On January 1st, a milestone for planet Earth. By best estimates, the global population has passed 8 billion. Joining us to talk about this is Patrick Hoovelein, an expert in sociology and demographics at the University of California, Los Angeles. Let's start with what the significance of passing this 8 billion number is.
Things have actually changed much more rapidly in the past 50 years than they have before. I think the estimate is that the first billion mark was hit around 1800, so it means that it took all of all of this time for humanity to reach that level. And then in recent years, it's happened every 12 to 15 years. So once we got to, I think, 3 billion in 1960, then we had another billion every 10 to 15 years up to now. So it is an occasion to remark how fast population has expanded from the 1960s until now. And the other fact that is interesting is as far as population projections are telling us. This won't happen many times or very quickly again. I think we're projected to get to 9 billion at some point this century, and maybe not to 10 billion, depending on which projection you're looking at. So this is something that was very rare, has become kind of more common. Adding 1 billion, getting to another 1 billion mark was very rare up to a certain point, and is likely to become very rare again. So we are in that middle period of the world.
I assume that the growth was due to better medicine, better food production. What is the... And now you say we're about to plateau.
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think?
So you're correct about the fact that the massive growth was due to mortality decline at a very fast pace. So those had the mortality decline that started to occur in European population in North America. In the 19th century, first slowly and probably due to improvement in nutrition, as you mentioned, food production, and then a bit more rapidly after better understanding of infectious disease through the germ theory around at the end of 19th century. What put the brake on that growth is the fertility declines around the world that happened in the later part of the 20th century, around in the 1970s, 1980s, and now in most, not all, but most of the world. So we're now in a situation where most countries are experiencing what demographers call below replacement fertility, which is in the long term, meaning that the generation would get smaller and smaller.
Is that fertility decline on purpose or is it biological?
No, I think in most countries it's by control, by couples wanting to have fewer children or wanting to postpone having a birth and using contraception for that purpose.
Can the Earth support 8, 9, 10 billion people?
So that has been a long question. There was a lot of research, actually, I mentioned in the 60s, 70s is when the population growth started to accelerate, and a lot of demographers were worried about the consequences of that. And there was some work on trying to figure out how many people can the Earth feed and support. And so if we look back at some of the estimates, we are doing better maybe than we thought. Food production has increased a lot, been able to accommodate this additional 5 billion, let's say, since 1960. Without some of the worst case scenario occurring in terms of poverty, nutrition, I think the concerns have shifted to the environmental impact of achieving this. That is, we have been able to increase food production and so on. But the impact on the Earth's resources has been substantial too. So by some estimates, we are using 1.4 times the annual capacity of the Earth to replenish its resources in fresh water and for example, and so on. So there is some concern, and in fact there is some evidence that at the current pace we are somewhat borrowing against future generation in our use of natural resources and Earth resources to accomplish that.
Patrick Kuvelein is a sociology professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. He has studied population growth and its impact on the planet. He co-authored the book Demography, Measuring and Modeling Population Processes, which is considered by some to be the Bible on the subject. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. And finally, some of those 8 billion people we were just talking about began the new year with a swim in crazy cold water.
I love you. Hey,
Dozens of swimmers, both local and tourists, took to the waters of the Adriatic Sea for the traditional Kukli swim on Slatina Beach in Croatia, with most wearing traditional striped bathing suits and Santa Claus hats, with water temperatures around 15 degrees Celsius.
It's my second time of the Opatija Kukli. It's the most famous thing on the 1st of January. In Austria now, the lakes, they have about 5 degrees. This is maybe 15. This is warm for me.
Now, this same thing happened at beach and lakes in those parts of the world where it's cold, experiencing winter on New Year's Day, from New York City to The Hague.
Here in Brooklyn's Coney Island, organizers say thousands of people signed up for the annual polar plunge in the Atlantic Ocean, celebrating 121 years. The beach is packed. The water is a frigid 45 degrees, give or take. The one saving grace, the sun has been poking out of the clouds. Having gone in myself, I can tell you this is a freezing but refreshing and fun event. Many are wearing nothing but bathing suits to take the plunge, but telling me it's a great way to start the new year off on a positive note.
It was so much fun. I'm so glad it's my first time doing it here. I'm from LA area, so I've done it on the West Coast.
And this polar plunge is also a fundraiser for a few charitable causes. In Coney Island, I'm Julie Walker.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since early December, less than a month after the horrific attack by Hamas terrorists on Israeli civilians, Yemen's Iran-based Houthi militants began to conduct almost daily drone and missile attacks against commercial vessels, transiting the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and the Strait of Hormuz. According to the U.S. Department of Defense, the Houthis have conducted over 100 drone and ballistic missile attacks, targeting merchant vessels involving more than 35 different nations. The Bab al-Mandeb Strait connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden, while the Strait of Hormuz is a conduit between the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It is an important maritime transit route. The recent escalation and reckless Houthi attacks originating from Yemen threaten the free flow of commerce, endangers innocent mariners, and violates international law, said Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
These attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And so we're taking action to build an international coalition to address this threat. And I would remind you that this is not just a U.S. issue. This is an international problem, and it deserves an international response.
On December 18th, Secretary Austin announced the establishment of Operation Prosperity Guardian, an important new multinational security initiative under the umbrella of the Combined Maritime Forces and the leadership of its Task Force 153, which focuses on security in the Red Sea. During a December 19th virtual meeting with top defense leaders of 43 countries and representatives from the European Union and NATO, Secretary Austin condemned the attacks on international shipping and global commerce as unprecedented and urged more nations to join the maritime efforts to counter them. Operation Prosperity Guardian is bringing together multiple countries to jointly address security challenges in the southern Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, with the goal of ensuring freedom of navigation for all countries and bolstering regional security and prosperity, said Secretary Austin. The Red Sea is a critical waterway that has been essential to freedom of navigation, and a major commercial corridor that facilitates international trade. Countries that seek to uphold the foundational principle of freedom of navigation must come together to tackle the challenge posed by this non-state actor launching ballistic missiles and uncrewed aerial vehicles at merchant vessels from many nations lawfully transiting international waters.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.